Good morning. My name is Deacon David Reitzel, and I'm grateful to have been invited here to preach to you. I am a seminarian at St. Augustine Seminary, studying for the Diocese of Hamilton. Father Lynch is one of my professors, and Father Mason is a former classmate of mine last year. And so just a bit about how I found myself in the seminary. I come from Waterloo. That's where I was born and raised. I grew up in a family of, there's nine of us, so I have eight brothers and sisters. And I went to school at Waterloo, I went to the University of Waterloo, and it was in my second year there that a friend of mine, who was thinking of becoming a priest, invited me to visit a seminary with him. And while I was there, listening to all the talks, I got a clear sense that God had a plan I understood what vocation meant. Up until that point, I thought that God's plan for our lives was very general, that he wanted us to be happy, he wanted us to be good. But it was at the seminary that they convinced me that God has a very particular plan for your life, and that it's your responsibility to find it, whether you're called to marriage or whether you're called to priesthood or religious life. And so, since I discovered this reality, that I need to figure this out, while I was at a seminary, I thought that maybe God was giving me a sign. And while I was at the seminary, I remember praying to God and asking him, "Do you want me to be a priest?" And the response that I received was silence. Confused about this silence, I approached one of the priests at the seminary and I asked him about it. And I said, "I just prayed to God. I asked him whether he wanted me to be a priest, and he didn't give a response." And he said, "Well, that's probably because you don't trust him enough. If God were to reveal to you right now what he had planned for your life, whether he wanted you to be a priest or whether he wanted you to get married, would you trust him enough to actually listen and follow wherever it was that he wanted you to go?" And the answer was very clearly no. My heart was set on going back to university and studying there. And so had he asked me to be a priest then and there, I probably would have said no. And so the priest said, "Well, it's very clear then that your job is to develop that trust so that you can reach a level where God is going to reveal to you what he has planned for your life and you can respond." And so that was at Christmas time of my second year at university. When I came back from Christmas break, I continued with my studies, but I began to pray more. I began to strengthen that relationship with God so that I could trust him enough that he would reveal what he had planned for my life. At the end of that semester, so this was the summer after completing my second year of university, I remember praying to God and asking him whether he wanted me to be a priest. And the very clear answer I got back was yes. And there were other signs that confirmed this, so it wasn't just a singular moment. Also, one of the great signs that I received was that my heart at that point had changed. At Christmas time, when I went to visit the seminary, I didn't want to be a priest. I had never thought of it up until that point, but by the time summer came, I couldn't think of anything else, and I actually wanted to leave university and enter into seminary. And since entering seminary, other things have confirmed it, and everything went well, and now I'm a deacon, and I look forward to May, when I will be ordained a priest, and I ask for your prayers leading up to May, that I may be a good priest, a holy priest, and I also ask in a special way for your prayers for the very first parish that I'm assigned to. Please pray for that parish. It's kind of a joke, but I do seriously ask for your prayers for that. So for the homily today. Throughout Jesus' ministry, he performed many miracles. He multiplied bread and fish. He healed lepers, he even raised the dead. But of all his miracles, the one performed at the Feast of Cana stands out for being the only one done to prevent social embarrassment. They had no wine, Mary tells us, a situation dreaded by all married couples on the day of their wedding. For the married couple at Cana, their banquet table likely would have been simple. They may have spent the extra money for meat, but there wouldn't have been much of it. For weddings like that, wine was the only affordable luxury that could be provided to their guests in abundance. But it ran out. How awkward. How embarrassing. That is, it would have been embarrassing if Jesus had not performed his first miracle and changed 600 liters of water into wine. Now we may ask ourselves why Jesus chose to perform what may seem to be such an unnecessary miracle. If we were to list the problems in the world, social embarrassment would rank near the bottom. Hunger, disease, death. Surely these were more worthy of a miracle than embarrassment. Yet it remains that in Scripture, Jesus' first miracle was for embarrassed newlyweds in Cana. So the question is, why? One common answer is that Jesus felt that he was the cause of the problem. When Jesus arrived in Cana for the wedding, he had just come from Jordan, where he was baptized by John, and where he had called his first five disciples, Andrew, John, Peter, Philip, and Nathanael. He had brought these five disciples with him to the wedding, who were no doubt not expected by the couple. Perhaps even Jesus was not expected, since he had so recently been away from his home. So the explanation runs that the chief steward had not planned for these six new guests, and so the wine ran out. And Jesus, realizing that he was the cause of this problem, made things right by changing water into wine. This explanation is common and sounds reasonable, but I do not think it holds up when we look at it a little closer. It makes sense that if you were planning a party for six and 12 show up, you have a problem. But what if you're planning a party for 20 and 26 show up? Is that as much of a problem? If you're planning a party for 40, 60, 80? As the party gets bigger, the six unexpected guests become less of an issue. Now, in the time of Christ, weddings were large affairs where nearly the entire village was invited. Family, friends, everyone was there. With that in mind, it's hard to see how Jesus and his disciples would have had a major impact on the wine shortage and why Jesus would feel responsible. So if that's not the reason Jesus performed his first miracle at the wedding of Cana, then what is? Well, I'd like to propose that the answer is found in our first reading. Today's first reading was from the book of the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah speaks about the restoration of Israel. Apparently, Israel had been experiencing hardship, the details of which we are not told. However, we do know that things were so bad that people called Israel a land that was desolate and forsaken by God. Times must be tough when people believe that God has forsaken you. But in the midst of this turmoil, Isaiah prophesies that God will come to his people and end this time of trial. And the language he uses to describe this intervention by God is the language of a marriage. Isaiah says, "For as a young man marries a young woman, so shall your builder marry you. And as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice over you." In other words, God will come, your suffering will come to an end, and the relationship between you and God will be like that of a husband and a wife. The people expected this prophecy to take place, that God would be as close to them as a bridegroom to a bride, and so they waited for the marriage. With this prophecy of Isaiah creating the expectation in Israel's heart of a marriage between them and God, we can understand then that when Jesus found himself at the wedding of Cana, it was the perfect opportunity for him to take the first step in revealing to the people that he was God. He had come to his people, and the wedding between them and God had begun. So the miracle of changing water into wine was not so much for the purpose of preventing social embarrassment, as much as it was to show that Jesus was divine. And in the context of a wedding, this meant that Isaiah's prophecy was being fulfilled. Now, what does this mean for us? Well, if Isaiah speaks of the relationship between God and man being like a marriage, and Jesus begins to fulfill this prophecy at a wedding, then we can ask ourselves, is our relationship with God like what Isaiah says, like a bridegroom and a bride? Forget all the romantic stuff. I mean, is our relationship with God one of unconditional, self-sacrificing love? That, after all, should be the relationship between a bridegroom and a bride. All those who are married promise to remain faithful to their spouses without condition, through good times and bad, in sickness and in health, all the days of their life. Well, are we faithful to God unconditionally? I know times can get tough, and faithfulness to God can mean going through suffering, but can we promise here and now that our love for him includes this suffering, that we will love him without condition for the rest of our lives? At the wedding feast of Cana, Jesus begins to fulfill the prophecy of Isaiah, that God desired to be united to us like a bridegroom to a bride. May you and I live faithfully this unity with God now, so that we might live it joyfully with him in heaven.